Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. A significant winter storm is bearing down on Southern California, while a fire is expanding in Santa Barbara County. We'll have the latest on both. Our Purple Project for Democracy continues with the Electoral College. Does it provide an important balance of voting power or inhibit democracy? Also this hour, the real history of Thanksgiving, or at least to the limits of our historical knowledge, and we'll ask teachers to share how they teach about the holiday. We'll get started with Air Talk right after NPR News.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your Thanksgiving week is going well so far and you're well into your planning, getting together with family and friends later in the week. Just a programming reminder that Film Week will air tomorrow at 11 o'clock so that you can be alerted to all the films that are opening on Thanksgiving Day. So again, Film Week tomorrow, 11 o'clock. Right here on 89.3 KPCC. But as you just heard on NPR News, there is severe weather across much of the U.S., particularly in the West, where low temperatures, snow, rain are in the forecast. In just a moment, we're going to hear from the National Weather Service with the very latest details over what's coming in the next few days. But first, what's happening right now in Santa Barbara County, the Los Padres National Forest, and the Cave Fire. KPCC reports Jacob Margolis is there. Jacob, thanks very much. What are the latest statistics on this fire?
Yeah, I've seen some conflicting numbers about acres burned. I've seen 3,800 and 4,100. But I think the thing to take away is that the winds have shifted from really pushing the fire, from the mountains towards the ocean, more towards kind of stalling them out in the hills. And that's a good thing, because obviously they're not encroaching down towards a lot of the homes, mobile home park that's up in those mountains. I'm sitting in my car right now and there is ash falling from the sky. The air quality is very bad, but it's sort of surreal to be sitting here experiencing that and then also think that like later today, early in the morning, there's going to be a major storm that rolls through and California's getting slammed by that. And so it's like a very California day.
And so fortunate to have that rain coming with a fire like this. Very rare for us to get that kind of a break weather-wise with a fire. Is there a count on how many homes have been evacuated up there?
I'm not quite sure. I know that there are some people that are being let back in or have gone back in. I did talk to some people down at an evacuation center who said that they were told to leave last night. However, as the fire has kind of slowed down, I imagine they're going to let some of those folks back in. The big concern was the winds, and with the winds slowing down, it's good news.
That is good news. KPCC reporter Jacob Margolis, by the way, a news conference scheduled at the Earl Warren Fairgrounds in Santa Barbara for 11 o'clock. And if that holds, we will bring that to you live. Jacob, is that news conference still on schedule to your knowledge?
Yes, as far as I know, absolutely.
All right. And what are the homes that are like on the periphery of the fire? Are these larger, more ranch-style, larger acreage properties, or are these more subdivisions with tract homes up there?
Yeah, I saw it. When I was up there, I saw a little bit of both. And like I said, there is a mobile home park up there that I met a few people from that had evacuated from. And so it is a mix of that very wealthy and probably middle class folks as well. The thing is that since it's not pushing kind of down towards the flat, down towards the town anymore, you know, that's good news for those people that live in maybe the smaller homes that don't have the humongous properties. But one of the things that I noticed when I was up in the mountains was this is an area that hasn't burned in a while. You could tell because it's like there are established plants up there. There are some oaks. And so that kind of stuff burns slower, but it can burn. It burns very hot. And if winds push it through, it's like a lot of fuel to really get the fire going versus a brush fire, say, which is going to burn hot. It's going to burn fast and it's going to burn out and kind of move on.
So this is north then, Jacob, of the huge fire that burned the periphery of Santa Barbara a couple years ago?
I believe so. It's an area that has burned before, but I was talking to a resident there and she's like, well, I remember this place burning back in like 1990 in the 1990s, you know? And so it's a normal period of time between fires, I would say, especially for California. The thing that happened is that we kind of went from like summer and extremely hot temperatures, dryness, haven't had really had rain since May pretty much. To now all of a sudden it's like cold and it could be, we can get some substantial rain and maybe even snow in the mountains. So we kind of missed fall, and all those Santa Ana winds that came out, just everything, it's a peek into what I feel like is our climate future, which are extremes kind of going back and forth. And as climate change progresses, you know, we could see bouts of rain, big bouts of rain, with even longer periods of dryness in between. So fingers crossed that this year, like last year, we get a lot of rain. We just don't know what's going to happen. However, the NOAA outlook for this year is that it will be hotter as well as potentially drier than average.
Jacob, thanks so much. We appreciate it. It's funny, the Thomas Fire that I was just referencing from 2 years ago, it started on December 4th, so just about a week from where we are now on the calendar, and it was 2 years ago. Jacob, thanks very much. We'll look forward to talking with you in our second hour. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
KPCC's Jacob Margolis is up covering the Cave Fire in Santa Barbara County in the Los Padres National Forest. Also with us to talk about the winds in Santa Barbara and other updates on our weather, meteorologist at the Oxnard office of the National Weather Service, Eric Bolt. Mr. Bolt, thank you very much for being with us. Is there going to continue to be good news on those winds in Santa Barbara throughout the day?
There is. The winds have pretty much backed off from what we saw last night. So, as mentioned, the winds are turning more onshore, and that's more out of the south or southwest direction, and they're much lighter today. Although there's still active fire and moving up the slope, and that's still showing up on our satellite imagery as some very hot fire conditions there yet this morning.
And when do we expect that area to first get the rain from the incoming storm?
Yeah, so the rain is coming down the northern California coast right now, and we should start to see it move into the Santa Barbara area probably after about 3 in the morning. So probably for a few hours right before sunrise, we'll see some accumulating rainfall. Right now we're thinking maybe a good half inch of rain. Some of those foothill areas could get as much as 1 inch of rain as we get into first thing tomorrow morning.
Do you anticipate that there will be any alerts issued for possible debris flows or mudslides?
It's not totally out of the possibility, but what we're thinking is the rain rates will stay below any threshold that kind of triggers those mudslides. So I think this first rain should be fairly good and kind of wet things down, maybe help put out the fire in many areas. And then we'll see some more active, maybe showers and maybe even a thunderstorm or two as we get into later Wednesday afternoon and into Thursday. Those heavier downpours will be most concerning as we go into that time frame.
And Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, is still anticipated to be the heaviest day of rain in the storm?
Right. Those heavier downpours could occur on Thanksgiving Day. It's just that they become less organized, and the odds of them hitting the fire is, you know, pretty slim. But we have to keep a close eye on that, because the rain rates at that point could be closer to an inch per hour in some of the heaviest downpours. And that's where we could have some problems with debris flows.
My limited knowledge of meteorology, I always thought of those storms that come in from the north, the colder winter storms, as not generating lightning. But I think you mentioned thunderstorms a possibility. What are the specifics of the weather that would generate those storms?
Really, all you need is very cold air that's over the top of us. So the air that's above the mountaintops will be very cold compared to what it is down here. And that's that instability that you need to generate thunderstorms. So that's why we're concerned about the potential for some isolated thunderstorms. You'll probably see some small hail as well across the area on Thursday. And the snow levels are going to drop down to as low as 2,500 feet. So some of our mountain ridges could get white.
2,500 feet. That seems like that's about as low as it gets here in Southern California. So we're going to have a white Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I think you'll be able to see some of those higher mountaintops covered in snow Thanksgiving Day. And then Friday, we should see kind of a diminishing trend in the shower activity.
Great. Anything else, Eric, to add for our preparation for this holiday week with the storms coming in?
I think the big thing is, because of those falling snow levels, just people should really be getting their travel done early, hopefully before Thanksgiving Day, and then be aware of the next storm system could arrive as early as Saturday evening, and Sunday could also turn out to be wet if you're having any travel plans.
Appreciate it very much. National Weather Service meteorologist Eric Bolt, who's at the Oxnard NWS office. Thank you for being with us. And he teed it up beautifully when he suggested traveling early to reach your holiday destination, because car travel expert Marie Montgomery Nordhuis of the Automobile Club of Southern California is with us to talk about that. Thank you so much, Marie, for being with us. What is expected to be the worst day for car travel this holiday week?
Good morning, Larry. Yes, Wednesday afternoon and evening is projected to be the worst day for travel, but I believe this afternoon and tonight is going to also be pretty congested as well. You're going to see traffic congestion up to five times greater than you would have normally on the I-10 eastbound between Santa Monica and the I-5 interchange. 405, the 10, and the 101, and the 5 are all going to be impacted by Thanksgiving traffic mixing with that commute traffic.
I don't know if you've spoken with the CHP to get their latest plans, but given that snow level, you'd be looking at snow on the Grapevine, potentially on the Cajon Pass as well. So people even going back and forth between Las Vegas and Southern California, and certainly up to Central and Northern California, wouldn't they be looking at potential serious delays because of snow?
Yes, and we're having so sort of a perfect storm here of things that are happening. We've got the fire in Santa Barbara. So we would normally advise people to avoid the 101, but your alternative is the 5, and the 5, of course, goes up through the Grapevine. So that is going to complicate travel. People probably, if you can leave early tomorrow morning, that's probably going to be the best bet. And it sounds like by the time if you're waiting until Thursday morning, you might have some accumulated snow and that travel could be more treacherous.
We're talking with Marie Montgomery Nordhuis of the Automobile Club of Southern California. What are the most popular destinations for metropolitan LA car travelers this weekend?
Sure. Well, the top five include Las Vegas is number one, San Diego number two, Mexico cruises and resort travel number three, the Grand Canyon, and Lake Tahoe. So we've got a lot of those impacted highways that we were talking about, potentially impacted by snow rain or fire.
Yeah.
All of this is happening at a bad time. So we're really advising people to try to get their travel out of the way as soon as possible.
Also, I was wondering about gas prices for this Thanksgiving weekend. You have at your fingertips sort of whether we're seeing an upward or downward trend on gas prices.
Yes, that is one very good piece of news. We're $3.88 a gallon on average in the LA Long Beach area. That's nearly 10 cents lower than a week ago. Prices are dropping rapidly. People should be looking to pay no more than $3.50 a gallon, and in many places even maybe $3.40 a gallon. So that is one good piece of news that we've got for travelers. About 85% of Thanksgiving travelers are going to be going by car. So
very good. And Marie, just any final pieces of advice for those of us that are going to be hitting the road for the long Thanksgiving weekend?
Yeah, well, you're really going to be wanting to check your road conditions. Obviously, there's a lot going on right now with the weather and the fire. So we would strongly advise you to use a GPS, have a passenger use GPS for you to make sure that the route that you're taking is still open. And there is also a number called the California Highway Information Number, 800-427-7623, and that number will update hourly with freeway closures throughout California.
Terrific, and we're going to put that on our AirTalk segment page where this conversation is there. Thank you, Marie, very much. The number again is 800-427-7623, and we'll have it on our AirTalk page at kpcc.org. That's Marie Montgomery Nordhuis of the Automobile Club of Southern California. So there you got an update on the fire, on the storm coming to Southern California, and snow coming to lower elevations, and then your holiday car travel and what you need to plan for. We have much more conversation coming up in this hour of Air Talk. The Purple Project for Democracy continues, and we're going to focus on the Electoral College, its pros and cons. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Actor and author LeVar Burton, and this part of the Purple Project for Democracy as we focus on the Electoral College. The Electoral College was laid out in the Constitution in Article 2, Section 1. Each state has as many electors as it has representatives and senators in Congress. When voters head to the polls to cast a ballot for president and vice president, they're really voting for the electors who are going to be formally casting those votes. The electors are expected to cast their ballots in the Electoral College, and most states require that all the electoral votes be cast in favor of the candidate who receives more votes than any other in that state. Joining us to talk about the pros and cons of the Electoral College is Garrett Epps, professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore. He's also the Atlantic's Supreme Court correspondent. Professor Epps, it's good to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me.
So share with us historically why we have an electoral college instead of a direct vote for the president.
Well, you know, that there's a lot of historical debate about that. I think that there are multiple reasons, but if you read the debates at Philadelphia, you can see that the very strong founders, the ones we most respect, started out saying, you know, the people should elect the president, and they would be brought up with various objections of why the people shouldn't do this. One of the undercurrents, of course, is that the slave states did not want popular election because for particularly Georgia and South Carolina were practically majority black states at that time. And so if the people voted, they would have significantly less influence on the result than if they could somehow make it a thing that states controlled. And that's eventually what happened. Madison said, you know, at one point in the debates, he says, well, the popular vote is obviously the best way to do it, but it won't work because the southern states will lose influence because of their slaves. So we have to do something else. And that, in essence, is what happened. It was a kind of a stopgap. No one had ever put a system like this together. And it went wrong almost from the very beginning. I was reading a letter from Hamilton to a friend in 1789 as the very first presidential election was going on. And he was writing, Hamilton, of course, is the guy who wrote in The Federalist how wonderful the Electoral College is, and we're always having that quoted to us. Hamilton's writing to a friend and said, do you realize what could happen? We might end up with Adams as president and Washington as vice president because this thing is so badly designed. It went wrong in 1796 when Adams was running, his running mate was Pinckney, but he got Jefferson, who spent the next 4 years trying to overthrow him. In 1800, it nearly brought the country to civil war. And we've had elections that went horribly wrong ever since, the two most recent ones being in 2000 and again 2016, where the Electoral College system produced the loser of the popular vote as president. So it's a little bit like one of those old Three Stooges routines where Mo is working somewhere and a bucket keeps swinging down on a rope and hitting him, and he never figures out what's hitting him. It happens over and over and over in American history that this particular improvisation by the founders almost ruins the whole thing. And so there are a lot of reasons why we want to get rid of it. Of course, that's more easily said than done.
And there are positives to it as well, which we'll talk about with Robert M. Hardaway, professor at University of Denver Law School. He's author of Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. Professor Hardaway, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for letting me come.
So one of the things that's said about the Electoral College is that it provides a dispersal of regional power that you wouldn't have under a popular vote, because you'd have cities essentially running roughshod over more rural areas if you had a straight popular vote. Certainly elections would be run very differently. Do you see that as one of the strengths of the Electoral College?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, John F. Kennedy, when he actually saved the Electoral College when he was in the United States Senate, pointed that out. He also pointed out that you really can't change one aspect of our solar system of government without changing the others. You can't change the Electoral College, of course, or abolish it unless all states agree. And that's because Article 2 gives the states a weight in the presidential election based on equal suffrage in the Senate. And of course, in the last sentence of Article 5, you can't change that formula. You can't abolish equal suffrage in the Senate unless every state agrees. So I think that it's very unlikely that any state would agree to abolish the Senate, upon which the weight that's given to each state in the union is based. So it really can't happen unless every state agree. And I think it's kind of pie in the sky stuff, because I just don't think Wyoming or Rhode Island is going to either abolish the Senate or give up their equal suffrage in the Senate. This notion of one vote per person, one vote is led some people to say, well, yes, of course, we do need to abolish the U.S. Senate. To give California, say, 51 senators, and Wyoming gets one. But that's not what the drafters of the Constitution had in mind.
Well, let's talk about that balance of power and how you have the Senate, which gives every state equal representation, and the House, which, of course, is proportional based on population. There, you have the two houses of Congress that have a kind of a counterbalance. With the Electoral College, you could argue that the national popular vote is essentially irrelevant. It's sort of, it's an interesting sideshow, but it really, what's really relevant is how the electors play out on who wins particular states. There isn't really any counterbalance in the national popular vote that would be comparable to the counterbalance the House provides to the Senate. Is that a problem for you?
As I would just quote Madison here, because John F. Kennedy and all the arguments in favor of the Electoral College were set forth by John F. Kennedy. And he cited Madison, who said, you know, the government we've created is not completely consolidated, nor is it completely federal. Who are the parties to it? The people, not the people as comprising one great mass, but the people as composing 13 sovereignties. And that's exactly what he was what the drafters were trying to achieve there. They didn't want a president. Some people have suggested we adopt the so-called direct election, which is the Russian system. It's also the French system. They use that, and they manage. If you have that Russian system, you can elect somebody as president with only 19 or 20% of the vote, which is what happened in 2017. Of course, there was a runoff, and that predetermines if someone will get a majority vote. But the person who in the first round got 21%, and was opposed by two-thirds of the entire electorate, won the election.
But we have two major parties here. Let me go back to Professor Garrett Epps, University of Baltimore. So how would you see it playing out if we went one person, one vote, the national popular vote decided the presidency? What would the effect of that be?
Well, I think we would have avoided the current president, who lost the popular vote by 3 million votes, which is, you know what, that's five times.
But I think you're misunderstanding my question. So what? How would it change the way? I'm not talking about the effect of who gets elected to office. I'm talking about, would you have someone like in Russia, 20-some percent of the votes elected? We have a two-party dominant system in this country. So let's not go back, rewind back in time, but looking forward, what would the effect be? How would it change campaigns? How would it affect, the two-party system?
Really important. And that is that it would make every vote in the United States matter. It's often said that the electoral system is important because it helps the small states. Well, that's actually demonstrably false. What happens every 4 years is that a certain number of states are swing states. Most of them are not small states. You know, they're Florida, they're Wisconsin, they're Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. And they receive, you know, as Andy Borowitz once wrote, we will now spend $1 billion trying to decide who's going to be president of Ohio. And so turnout in those states, campaigning in those states, that becomes the focus of the entire political system. If you had a national popular vote, every vote would matter, and candidates would have every incentive, for example, to go into the states where they are strong, where they are sure of receiving a majority of the vote, to make sure that turnout is strong. Small states would matter as much as large states. And the second thing is, and this is something that is a theme throughout American history, is that under the electoral system, local political leaders in states have every incentive to suppress the vote. Because, you know, the state of Oregon, for example, has 7 electoral votes. Those 7 electoral votes will be cast whether 50% of the voters vote or 80%. It doesn't matter. And so if one party has control, if you take a look at a state, I grew up in Virginia at a time when maybe 16 to 17% of the voting age population was allowed to vote. Virginia got its full share of electoral votes, and it was much easier for the segregated political machine to handle making sure that it got its way in national councils because it had control over who voted and it had control of those electoral votes. So, you know, I think generally democracy, that is a system of law in which the majority, what's called the Republican principle, decides issues, produces better outcomes than minority rule. Or
Garrett Epps of University of Baltimore joining us on Air Talk. I'd love to hear from you at 866-893-KPECC. Lucille in Long Beach, you're on Air Talk.
I would like to ask why the Electoral College doesn't move to, and I know that there are two states that do, but the majority don't, to allocating the Electoral College votes by the percentage of the popular vote in each state, which seems that it would be a lot more fair than this winner takes all. If you get 50.1%, you get all the votes.
Yeah, Lucille, Professor Robert Hardaway, University of Denver, why isn't it proportional like that?
Well, some states do something like that. Maine and Nebraska have decided to do that. That's the district method, but basically it's a proportional method. And every state has the option. California was given a referendum, offered a referendum, in which they could allocate their electoral votes proportionally. Colorado was also given that referendum, given that option. They all rejected it, just like the founding, most of the founding fathers at the beginning rejected it. So every state can do that.
What are the reasons people are against awarding the electors proportionally?
Well, each state can do that. They're entitled.
No, but you mentioned there was a referendum in California. So what was the argument against it that people made?
Because they said they don't want to share any electoral votes with the Republican. They figured the state is locked up for the Democratic candidate. And they want to have all 50 or so electoral votes go to their candidate. They don't want to share their electoral votes with someone with a Republican. That's basically their reason.
All right.
Let's say that you had a proportional vote and Clinton would get 30 electoral votes. Trump would get 25. So their net effect on the election would be 5 electoral votes. California doesn't want to be marginalized in that way.
Let me go back to Professor Garrett Epps, University of Baltimore, just real briefly, sir. What about recounts? One of the other knocks on doing a national popular vote is if you had an extremely close popular vote, you'd end up with recounts all across the country, where it's far easier to do targeted recounts with an electoral college system.
Yeah, you know, that argument doesn't sow a lot of oats for me. It seems to me that we need to have an electoral system, and this is separate from what we do with the Electoral College. We have to have a secure voting system that produces the kind of setup that can be easily recounted. Oregon, where I live for many years, has that. They have a vote-by-mail system that uses paper ballots. It's completely accountable. There's a paper trail. Recounts take, you know, a day or two at most. There's no reason the country as a whole can't go to that. And the idea that we somehow want to jimmy our system and make it undemocratic and make it accessible for minority rule because it might be difficult to do recounts, I think is kind of cart before horse. I think we can do both.
All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much. That's Garrett Epps, University of Baltimore, constitutional law professor, and he's the Supreme Court correspondent for The Atlantic. Robert M. Hardaway of the University of Denver, professor of law. His book just published this year, Saving the Electoral College, Why the National Popular Vote Would Undermine Democracy. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the history of Thanksgiving. What is the holiday based on in the way of actual events? And how has the teaching of Thanksgiving evolved? If you're a school teacher, you're off for this Thanksgiving week. I'd love to hear the way in which you teach Thanksgiving to your students. I'd be interested also if looking back on your childhood school years, if you thought Thanksgiving was taught in a particularly effective way, what way was that? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in just a minute 30. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Again, I hope you're having a terrific Thanksgiving week and maybe getting the long weekend or even more. That's great. And if you're out for the school break, your school, your district is off this week, I have a task for you if you're a teacher or a student who could share with us how Thanksgiving is taught at your school, or if you're a teacher, how you teach it to your students. I'd love to hear about it. 866-893-KPECC, the legend of a three-day Thanksgiving feast in November of 1621 between starving religious pilgrims from England and the native Wampanoag tribe in what's now Plymouth, Massachusetts, may well have some truth to it, but scholars have been debating the full context of Thanksgiving, how it's being taught, and the way that we celebrate it. With us is historian and anthropologist Peter Mancall of USC. He specializes in Native American and early American histories. Professor Mancall, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry. I'm delighted to be on.
Let's start with what we think actually occurred in this feast between the Native Americans in what's now Massachusetts and these pilgrims from England. What do we have evidence for?
Well, we know that the English pilgrims arrive in Plymouth, or really New Plymouth, in the fall of 1620. They have a pretty tough winter. A number of them pass away. And then they start to do somewhat better. So the spring and into the fall of 1621, you know, they bring in a pretty good harvest. And what we know is we have two slight records that sometime in that fall, the pilgrims got together with local Wampanoags and sat down to some sort of feast. According to the record, they ate deer. I think we all presume that they ate turkey, which was fairly common in the area. And beyond that, that's almost the sum total of the documents that we have for that first meeting for the origins of Thanksgiving that we have now. There are other historians, other people who argue that the first Thanksgiving of English colonists happened earlier in Virginia, but the one that we think about, the one that we celebrate, the one that's become the iconic Thanksgiving is what happened in Plymouth in 1621.
And what do we know about the relationship between members of the Wampanoag tribe and the immigrants who came from England? What degree of cooperation was there versus rivalry?
Well, I think we have to, you know, set this into the context of other English migrants who'd come to North America earlier. And because I think what happens in Plymouth actually follows a pattern. And the pattern is that in this case, the English pilgrims arrive and they realize in order to survive, they have to have some sort of positive relations with the local peoples who are there. The pilgrims are the unintended beneficiaries, the unlikely or accidental beneficiaries of an epidemic that had come through southern New England from 1617 to 1619, which made the area less populous than it had been earlier. And at first, I think what we can reconstruct from the documents are people trying to sort of get along with each other. Over time, as the colonies grew, and we see this in Virginia, just like we see it in New England, as colonies become more numerous and they put more pressure on indigenous peoples, on native peoples in southern New England in this case, then tensions arise. And sort of the part of the what historians wrestle with is how do we get from, say, 1620, 1621 to 1637, when we have the first large-scale war in New England between English colonists and local peoples.
And is much of that just because the number of immigrants coming from England starts swelling and you've got a resource issue and you know, friction with the Native Americans? Is much of it a numbers factor?
Well, part of it is a numbers factor. I mean, that's a great way of phrasing the question. Part of it is a numbers factor, and part of it actually tells us something about the ways that different populations sort of dealt with each other. So one thing we know about this part of North America is before Europeans arrive, Native peoples in this area do not have livestock in the way that we think of that today. And so the English come and they bring cows and sheep and pigs and horses. And when they first arrive, that's when the English first arrive, it's fairly time consuming to put up fences. So they just let these animals browse freely. And a number of these animals tended to then wander off, and they wandered into native people's fields. They destroyed native pigs, destroyed clam banks. And so we sort of see encroachments, I should say, on indigenous, for lack of a word, property or resources that needed. Over time, native peoples do adopt some of these animals. But part of what leads up to the hostility in the 1630s seems to be cases of trespass. That is, whether it's human trespass, of people going onto lands, of English colonists going onto lands that they shouldn't have, or native peoples going into English property that the English believe they have then purchased and have to themselves, or animals crossing these boundaries, you know, all the time. And so basically, I think, you know, the best way to sort of step back from this, say, there were a lot of these small scale infractions going on, and eventually they built up into a lot of mutual suspicion on the part of Wampanoags and other Algonquian-speaking peoples that the English were there to take their property, and suspicion on the part of the colonists that the natives were going to gang up against them and attack them. And those mutual suspicions exploded in 1637.
We're talking with USC Professor of History and Anthropology, Peter Mancall. He specializes in Native American and early American history, so he's the perfect person to talk with us about what we know historically about Thanksgiving and the feast that's believed to have inspired the later creation of the national holiday. If you have questions for Peter about this period, we're at 866-893-KPCC. But I'm also really interested in hearing about how Thanksgiving is taught, about sharing, about cross-cultural appreciation, about the way that the migrants who came from England and the Native American members of the Wampanoag Nation, how they related at this time. How is this taught? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Professor Mancall, how is Thanksgiving typically taught today?
Well, that's a good question, and you know, this is where, you know, being a professor with college students, I'm, you know, not exactly on the front lines. But every summer, I do meet, along with a small group of early American historians, we meet with a group of about 30 school teachers who come to Los Angeles, and we talk about the early colonial period. We talk about the period really from about the time Columbus comes through the founding of Jamestown and the founding of New Plymouth. And in those conversations, which are really is a great dialogue, I get the sense that there are a lot of teachers who really want to sort of integrate the newest scholarship that historians are providing and discussing about sort of, you know, in some sense, what really happened, or at least what we really think happened. And they're wrestling with, you know, really longstanding embedded traditions that are not so much politically conservative, but sort of culturally conservative. You know, people have certain ideas about Thanksgiving. So typically you'll still hear teachers, and maybe some of your callers, some call in and talk about this, you'll still hear teachers say that they have the kids put their hand on a piece of construction paper and do an outline of their fingers and make a turkey. And there are probably still people out there who remember dressing up maybe as pilgrims on the one hand and as Wampanoags on the other hand. I mean, you can go online to Google and do a search, and you can find a lot of these people have taken pictures of how they've dressed up. I think one thing that historians want to do is not tell people how to celebrate the holiday, but to sort of say, maybe we've reached a point, or let's hope we've reached a point, where let's try to talk about this in a historically accurate sense, and let's try to be culturally sensitive, and let's not try to depict people in ways that they didn't look like or ways that they didn't sound like. And let's see if we can use the historical record to provide something more accurate as a basis for how we want to talk about this national holiday. I mean, the holiday itself is a 19th century creation. It's only a national holiday as of 1863. So the holiday is long after the events in Plymouth in 1621.
And I think you could argue it could even exist independently of historic events if the purpose of the holiday is to celebrate thankfulness and for people to think about the blessings that they have, either from being Americans or their family or their friends, whatever, however they define the things for which they're happy. 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Harole is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're looking forward to Thanksgiving on Thursday by looking back at the source material for the story of Thanksgiving with members of the Wampanoag tribe in what's now Massachusetts, feasting with the immigrants who came from England, the pilgrims meeting and having this famous feast. What do we see from the historical record? And then also, how has the holiday evolved? Laura, in Redondo Beach, I understand you teach kindergarten. How do you use this with your students?
Well, you know, it's been a controversial thing in my own mind and heart because I wanted to do it well, and I've been doing it for a very long time, and we always have done the little feast, and I've reconsidered all of that, and what I try to do is really present as balanced a view as I can. So I teach the kids that indeed the Wampanoag were helpful to the pilgrims and that mutual cooperation is good and mutual support is good and kindness and good is good. And that initially this was all true. But then I remember I teach very little children. So
yes.
It's very simple. But then I also say to them that eventually with those numbers, as you folks talked about increasing, it did seem like they were saying, we love your land, we love your homes, and now we're going to need to move you off a little bit. And I asked them, even five-year-olds can consider how that might feel to them, to have someone that you've shared with and taken, you know, been supportive of, to then start encroaching. And then I kind of leave it to parents, and I ask them to please open these conversations with their children. I just try to present a balanced view, that it wasn't all, you know, fun and games, so to speak, and that these are serious issues that have arisen because of this.
But there's still an ideal to convey, and it sounds like you do that as well as in an age-appropriate way trying to give a more holistic look. Professor Peter Mancall, UCLA, what do you think about Laura's approach with her kindergartners?
Well, I think her approach is terrific. I think it's very important for us when we try to teach these events to recognize that we don't have a lot of documentary evidence, that we come to this with these very strong cultural traditions. And I think it is really important. If one of the lessons that comes to this is that we have to respect each other's traditions, I mean, I think that's very important. I think respect is a hugely important thing, and it is worth giving thanks about, you know, on this holiday. It is complicated because, you know, I think if you deviate or if one deviates from a norm, you know, I mean, I'm not a teacher of small children. You know, if one deviates from a norm, I would imagine that there could be parents who are thinking, why isn't Thanksgiving, this old American holiday, being taught in the way that I knew it when I was a kid? So I think we have to recognize, all of us, that the way we think about the past evolves over time. And the easiest example for us in California, among other places, is to think, okay, what happened to the holiday that we used to call Columbus Day and is now Indigenous Peoples Day? I mean, that holiday was celebrated by many Americans for a long time until about 1992, when, you know, as one critic pointed out, Columbus got mugged on the way to his own party. And now Columbus Day in many parts of America is fading away, being replaced by something else. What's going to happen with Thanksgiving? Is Thanksgiving going to have a similar trajectory, or is Thanksgiving going to be sort of divorced from that and sort of remain, you know, in some sort of pristine, you know, bubble as an unchanging event? And I think that is a question historians can't answer.
So real quickly, I need sort of the thumbnail sketch of this, but when was Thanksgiving created as a national holiday, and how was it tied to this feast event?
So, Thanksgiving as a national holiday is created in 1863 when Abraham Lincoln sort of succumbs to this public campaign that was led by a woman named Sarah Jephesus Hale. And he decides, okay, there should be Thanksgiving. So this is in the middle of the Civil War. You know, Lincoln obviously sees some advantage to sort of saying, okay, let's think back. Let's sort of give praise to God as he thought about it, they thought about it at the time. I mean, that's the specific origins. It had been celebrated in different places. There have been regional celebrations, but as a national holiday, it actually dates to this very fraught moment in our history when North and South were still fighting each other. And, you know, I think you could say a civil war story. You could say, well, the tides of war have changed somewhat by then. But I think it was an effort to say, okay, this is a war-torn country. We need to find a way forward. And this sort of way that it's to think about a day of Thanksgiving and to link it to what seemed rather, in the histories of the time, rather gentle moment of the 1620s seemed appropriate.
Let's talk with Nicole in Oak Park. Nicole, what did your school do, or what does it do for Thanksgiving?
Yes, so I found out on the second grade, they had a very nice idea of celebrating the heritage because we have a quite diverse group of kids from diverse backgrounds, and it was lovely to have a spread. Each brought food from their own home country or parents' country, wore traditional stuff, and their concept was also related to that. And I thought that speakers pointing out, as a teacher, that times have changed and people are different, but there's always a way to come together and learn how to get along. So I thought that celebration of heritage during the Thanksgiving time was really nice.
Yeah, and it's interesting because of people bringing their different foods. It's sort of a celebration of immigration as well, and mixing of different peoples in the United States. Nicole, I appreciate that very much. Thank you so much. I want to thank Professor Peter Mancall, professor of history and anthropology at USC. He specializes in Native American and early American histories. We have much more to come on the second hour of Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. And speaking of this being a holiday week, tomorrow, 11 o'clock, Film Week, coming a couple days early because of all the holiday films that are coming out this week. We don't want you to miss those reviews. Wednesday at 11, it's Film Week. Such a pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Reminder, tomorrow, 2 days earlier than usual, Film Week at 11 o'clock. Our critics will be here to talk about the week's big movies. That way, should you choose to go to a film on Wednesday or Thursday, you'll know all about the new ones. You don't have to wait till Friday's Film Week here on 89.3 KPCC. While law enforcement confirmed that the weapon that was used in the recent Saugus High School shooting was a so-called ghost gun, that's a homemade firearm that doesn't have a serial number on it. The gunman identified as a 16-year-old Saugus High School student who died of injuries, suffered from a self-inflicted wound. He used the handgun to shoot five students. Two of his classmates were killed. It was a .45 caliber model 1911 pistol that was believed to have been put together with parts that someone, either the shooter or someone else, then assembled. Joining us to talk about how so-called ghost guns work is Matthew LaRossiere, who is director of legal policy at the Sacramento-based gun rights organization, Firearms Policy Coalition. Sir, thank you for being with us. So explain to us how these unserialized assembled guns work.
Okay, so basically what you have to understand is that under U.S. law, one component is what's considered the firearm. And it's kind of random and unprincipled what ATF considers to be the firearm. That said, everything else you can generally order online and get shipped straight to your door because, you know, when the people have a right to keep and bear arms, they should be able to get replacement parts for it.
Okay.
And we have the background check system and stuff. You need to get that one. There's one piece that absolutely needs to go through a dealer if it's getting, you know, shipped interstate or you know, whatever.
Is this what's called the frame?
The frame or the receiver, yeah.
Okay. So the frame or the receiver, that does have to be registered, you said?
No, not registered. So there is no national firearms registry that is specifically federally illegal. Some states have firearm registries, and California has a, you know, assault weapon registry, for example, but that is the part that is serialized.
And okay.
That's why this gets to the, you know, a lot of the confusion in this ghost gun things is people have this kind of CSI-inspired fantasy that firearms can be traced, that, you know who has it or what bullet came from it. That's actually not true. We just know that the frame or receiver has a serial number, and what you can get, what ATF can get with that serial number is the last firearms dealer that the firearm went through. That's it.
So when they talk about a ghost gun, though, it sounds like these are not frames that or receivers that have a serial number on them.
Right. So when there's no federal firearms licensed person involved, no manufacturer, you know, just an individual who decides to make the firearm themselves, they are not subject to those laws that require serialization federally. In California, it's been required to get a unique serial number from the DOJ, the California Department of Justice, since about 2018 when you're making a home-built firearm.
Okay.
Yeah, so obviously people are breaking those laws, but we've had home-built firearms, and there's been no serialization requirement. As long as you don't make the firearm with intention to sell it, like you can't fire up your 3D printer and make these firearms and sell them online, that's not legal. That said, it is tremendously rare for these firearms to be used in crime.
What, and we'll follow up on that point in a moment, what's the manufacturing process? If someone's going to make a lower receiver or a frame for a rifle or for a handgun, what kind of equipment does someone need to do that?
Well, I'm going to give you the terribly unsatisfying lawyerly answer of it depends. So the shooter in Santa Clara that, you know, everybody's most worried about right now, that was the 1911, the 45 caliber handgun. That comes as a block of steel, and you need quite a bit of equipment to, you know, cut the shapes out of it, to turn it from a piece of what could be, you know, what's legally considered scrap metal. In California, it's considered a precursor part. Everywhere else, it's considered scrap metal. And cut that into all of the shapes and geometry that's needed for the firearm to work. Something like an AR-15 can be made from plastic or even wood. Functional AR-15 receivers have been made from any of these parts, and that can. There's a person who on YouTube, I don't know if the video's been taken down now, but he carved an AR-15 receiver out of a chunk of wood with files. So that's kind of the full spectrum, you know, analysis of it right there.
We're talking with Matthew LaRosière, Director of Legal Policy at the gun rights organization Firearms Policy Coalition. Also with us from the Brady United Against Gun Violence nonprofit gun control organization, Steve Lindley. He's the program manager for Brady in Los Angeles. Mr. Lindley, thank you very much for being with us. Anything to add about what it takes to construct one of these so-called ghost guns?
Well, I think it's far easier than was earlier stated. They come in a what's considered an 80% whole state. They have the drill holes marked out. It's actually a very easy process that you could mainly use a Dremel tool. And this is for both for the aluminum or for the plastic lower receiver. So it's an easy process. It's unregulated throughout the country except for California. And we're starting to see far more of these ghost guns show up at crime scenes because California regulates assault weapons, and you can get these ghost guns right now with pretty much without a background check. And it is on the honor system that if you decide to make that 80% lower into a full firearm, then you need to apply with the California Department of Justice for a background check and for a serial number. We can trace back in California the firearm at a crime scene back to the last person, not to the last dealer who purchased the firearm. So firearm tracing through the alcohol and tobacco and firearms is a long established process. It is a good law enforcement tool, and that's what California is looking at, is to make sure that people who are producing these firearms has a background check on them, they're not prohibited from owning a firearm, and that it has a serial number that law enforcement can trace back to that individual.
If this is already illegal, though, in California to sell the lower receiver or the frame without it being serialized, how can law enforcement better enforce that law? What are some of the challenges in doing that?
Well, one of the challenges that we still have is that this can be done over the internet. So not only the 80% lower receiver can purchase over the internet and delivered to your door, all the precursor parts to make that firearm can also be sent to your door. With that, it's hard to control. So if we have, like in other parts of California law, when it comes to firearm and ammunition purchases, those have to be done in person. You have to go down to a dealer. You have to go through the background process. And once you pass that process, then you're allowed to take those items with you. And that's what part of Assemblymember Gibson's bill, Assembly Bill, what was it, 879, will do. Problem with that, it doesn't really, it takes effect in two different parts, and that's in 2024 and 2025. We need to solve the problem a little bit quicker than that.
We're talking with the Brady United Against Gun Violence organization program manager for L.A., Steve Lindley, former bureau chief for the California Department of Justice up until just about a year ago. If you have questions about so-called ghost guns, those are ones where the major part of the firearm, either the lower receiver for the rifle or the frame for the handgun, doesn't have a serial number on it, give us a call. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. So, Mr. Lindley, for someone to sell a firearm on the internet without a background check is illegal, and presumably there would be a way to find that individual who sold a firearm illegally online and to prosecute that person. Why is it not similarly effective to do it for someone who sells an unserialized lower receiver or frame to a California resident?
Well, if it is a completed lower receiver or frame, that is considered to be a firearm at that point under federal law, so they would have to go through a background check, not only a federal background check, but a state background check. That's how these ghost guns or the 80% lower receivers are getting around that, because under federal law, a firearm frame has to be more than 80% complete for it to be considered a firearm. That's why these ghost gun manufacturers keep the frame at a 80% or less construction, that way they can sell it and it's not considered a firearm.
But can't California law usurp federal law on that point?
It only for firearms that are in California, but it's still somewhat on the honor system because you can still have these firearms or the lower receivers delivered to your door.
All right.
With the new bill that will take effect in July of 2024, those type of transactions need to be in person. You'll have an individual in California, if they want to purchase that, will have to go to a 80% lower receiver vendor here in California, very similar to how the California ammunition background check system is set up, and receive that item in person when they conduct that background check.
All right. Also with us, Matthew LaRossier of the Firearms Policy Coalition. Sir, what do you think of that bill that was just talked about? Do you think that that would be burdensome for gun owners who want to assemble their own gun?
Frankly, it's just a bunch of garbage, right? It's not really relevant who it puts the burden on. It's what the practical effects are. And the practical effects are no countervailing increase in public safety with a attendant, just one more thing to the list of what police can lock you in a cage for if they find, you know, during a traffic stop or in these neighborhoods that are heavily policed where the existing laws are already enforced. A couple things that I'd like to say. My friend from Brady mentioned that, you know, he said that I kind of undersold how difficult it was. I'm not trying to do that. I do not think that the difficulty of assembling these firearms is relevant in any way to how they should be regulated, especially because I mentioned that you can literally carve them from a block of wood with a chisel. It can be pretty easy to do. If you're going to live in a society where people have the right to keep and bear arms, you have to tolerate the right to keep and bear arms, right? At some point, you make it is illegal to do. I'm not aware of any criminal law that is not predicated on the honor system to ultimately be enforced. And we have criminal penalties, as we do for murder, which has been illegal for as long as I can remember. Ultimately, somebody has to break that honor system in order to break the law.
All right. Steve Lindley, quick closing comment from you. Do you think that this new proposed bill would, in fact, decrease the number of unserialized weapons that are constructed?
So background checks on firearms have been proven to be successful in lowering gun violence around the nation. That's not really in dispute. So there's a loophole here that is going to be fixed in, at least by 2024, hopefully sooner. And when we have background checks on firearms or 80% receivers, we keep prohibited people from possessing those firearms.
All right. All right. I want to thank you, sir. Steve Lindley, Brady United Against Gun Violence, Matthew LaRossiere of Firearms Policy Coalition. You can share your comments about so-called ghost guns on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. So I don't know if you saw that story about the Utah stepmother who was topless working in the garage. Her stepkid saw her. They told their birth mother about it. She reported the stepmom, and the stepmom is now being prosecuted for lewd conduct. I'm not so interested in talking about that specifics of the case in Utah, but I do want to talk with you about nudity among family members in the home. What do you think of it? Is it something that you grew up with, that you were comfortable with? Maybe something your parents would be nude around and it bothered you. I want to hear from you. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Back in less than 2 minutes. I should let it play until the great trombone line in that song. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. We're using just as a point of departure this Utah case where a stepmother is being prosecuted for being topless, working in the garage, and her stepkid seeing her and telling their birth mother, the birth mother reporting the stepmother for being nude in front of the kids, or partially nude. And so the stepmom's being prosecuted for lewdness. Now, I don't want to get into the details of that case because, as always, there are further individualized complexities. But the point is, do you think it's okay for family members to be naked in front of each other? There are some families I know who are very free about that. And it's not even that they're necessarily dedicated naturists, I guess is the expression, but just they're not fussy about being unclothed in front of each other. Maybe it's the same gender, mother and daughters or father and sons. In other households, perhaps everybody covers up all the time. So I'd like to know, what did you grow up with? And if it wasn't a good fit for you, were you heard by your parents? Did they change because of something you said? Or is it something you just endured? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Anna, in West Hollywood, how did you grow up with this? Were people covered up or was there nudity in your household?
Yeah, so my mom was often topless around me growing up. It was pretty normal, and I think she made me more aware and comfortable with my body because of it. And I've also always, it made me feel more comfortable, like in the women's locker room, like around my peers. And for me, I've always been like seeing women's bodies, especially women's tops, is not sexual or an issue at all.
So. Now, did that for you then, were you comfortable being at least partly unclothed at home, or did you typically cover up when you were a girl?
Oh, I was topless all the time. I was definitely kind of a tomboy, and it made me really comfortable. And I also wanted to bring up this topic, is really important to me, because about 4 years ago, I was arrested for being swimming topless in my complex pool in West Hollywood. And
in West Hollywood, of all places.
Yeah, and it was Pride weekend, which is crazy. But there was a whole, I was arrested for indecent exposure, which it's not indecent exposure for women's tops to be exposed.
Yeah.
The issue,
and I appreciate it, but I really don't want to get into that separate issue. We've actually done segments on women being topless in public, but I appreciate you sharing your experience. I really do want to focus on the family dynamics, particularly if it's cross-gender. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Lori, in West Los Angeles, what was your experience with this growing up?
Well, I grew up in West LA, and there were three of us, my parents and myself, and we just didn't wear clothes in the house unless we had company or it was cold. So I didn't even know about pajamas and stuff until I started sleeping over with friends. But the fun story I wanted to tell was, on Christmas morning, my mother would always put on bagpipe music on the record player, and we would march around the house several times before we found our robes and sat down to open the presents.
All right. Well, every family has its traditions, right, Lori? So
exactly.
That's fun. Did you ever share with your friends when you were growing up that your family didn't wear clothes around the house? And if you did, what did they think of that?
It was normal to me, and I was always surprised at how bundled up everybody was. And so, yeah, I would talk to my friends all the time about it.
All right. Lori, I appreciate you sharing the experience. Danica in Baldwin Hills, appreciate your being with us. So, Danica, what was your experience growing up with this?
So my experience with it, my mom was very free, so that transcended it to my parenting. And I nursed all four of my sons, and from then it just became natural. We took baths together. We, to this day, they're in their early 20s, some in their late teens, and it's very normal for them to just walk in on me, literally on the toilet when I'm getting ready to get into the shower and I'm topless and they're asking me questions about dinner or money or anything. It's just not a thing with my family with regard to the nudity, especially, I mean, you would think maybe with boys I would be a little more shy, but it wasn't. It's just my mom's breast. It's not a big deal.
Danica, did you grow up in a household like that?
So my mom was kind of a hippie from Long Island, so kind of. She had a lot of friends who were over a lot, and they would be nude and, you know, kind of hanging out and having fun. And so it wasn't a thing. I grew up with a book called Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Yeah, sure. It sold millions of copies.
Yeah, never saw it as a thing, you know, it didn't bother me. And we, you know, we were just in Sicily last summer and their mom's 50 years old jumping off of a boat topless, and it doesn't faze my boys at all. So,
yeah, Danica, did one of your sons ever express any negative feeling about your walking around uncovered in the house, or did all of them seem to accept this?
And, No one has ever said anything to me.
All right. Hey, Danica, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you in Baldwin Hills. Paul writes on the Air Talk Facebook page, a friend and I heard this being promoted about the Air Talk segment, and she immediately brought up her impression of my childhood as if I grew up in a nudist colony. Not the case in the least, but I can say there was no shame about being in the buff when I felt I was too old for PJs and wanted to imitate my much older siblings who slept in the nude. Not a big deal. If I had to dart from my bedroom to the bathroom in my birthday suit, this seems like a healthier way of dealing with something I don't understand as an issue versus my friend's fear of being exposed. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Let's talk with Kevin in Burbank. Kevin, I understand your parents were immigrants from Poland. So what was your childhood experience like with being clothed or unclothed?
Well, my mother had 12 kids, and even though we're no French, I believe the entire country is now in France shocked about this case in Utah. We're Polish, and like I said, my mother had 12 kids, and seeing my mother dressing and undressing was just a regular thing. It was a magical connection with my mom that we all had, that we saw that woman and her body was where we came from. And it was a beautiful thing, and it just connected us a lot stronger than anything else.
Kevin, appreciate it. Thank you. Love hearing about also, you know, different cultural backgrounds. Nasima in Los Feliz said, I have an Iranian mother, and growing up, nudity was never in my house. Even when we went to the all-women section of a spa, she wouldn't get naked. That's Nasima in Los Feliz. So there, another experience. Again, don't know whether that's cultural from where Nasima's mother came from or not. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Home nudity, nudity in the family. What do you think? Is it something made you uncomfortable as a child or something that helped you be accepting of the body? We'll be back in 1 minute.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're using as a very thin point of departure, if you will, but the Utah story of the stepmother who's being prosecuted for indecency. She was topless and her stepkids saw her. The stepkids told their birth mother about it, who reported the stepmom to authorities, and now the stepmom is being charged. And we're not talking about the specifics of, you know, women's versus men being topless and about, you know, prosecuting in that circumstance. But it is a great occasion to talk about how families are comfortable or not with nudity in the home. Roxanne in San Dimas says, growing up, my parents wanted my brother and me to never be ashamed of our bodies. So they regularly walked around naked after getting out of the shower or changing to go swimming. It really made an impact, Roxanne says, as my father is 350 pounds. 866-893-KPCC. Let's talk next with Patricia in Mar Vista. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
I was in Sweden many years ago, and we took a little boat, and it was a grandmother and her granddaughter and my best friend and her husband. And we went out in the fjords, and we got on the rocks and lay down the blanket, and the grandmother took her clothes off, and the granddaughter took her clothes off, and the son took his clothes off, and they all jumped in the water. And I was sitting there with my mouth gasped. And so my friend said, what's the matter? And I said, she's a grandmother. She's nude. And she said, and she's in front of her son. And she said, oh, Pat, she said, that's how it is here in Sweden. She said, everybody, you know, they're not ashamed of their bodies, and nudity is a common thing.
Wow, Patricia, thanks. What a great experience. I can just see it. It's like in a Swedish film or something. Patricia, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Rob in Montrose, what's your family experience with being naked?
Hi, Larry. I grew up with a Methodist pastor for a father. And after 7 p.m., he was very comfortable being naked. And most often either in skivvies or pretty much walking around the house naked.
So like some people won't take an alcoholic drink until after six. Your father, it like hit 7 o'clock and his clothes would come off. That's funny.
Absolutely. And my mother, my first mother, was very much evangelical and very much against that kind of thing. So he didn't start doing that until later in life. My second mother is very comfortable with it. And now I'm in a relationship where my wife is aghast at the thought that I would even walk from the bathroom to the bedroom naked in front of her, in front of our stepson.
Really? So is that something you talked about before your relationship got serious with your wife or your girlfriend?
Something I started to notice, and now I'm a little more careful, but I'm also very comfortable being naked, maybe because of my father.
All right, Rob, I appreciate it. A wonderful anecdote, 866-893-KPECC. Donna Marie in Claremont said, I'm an adopted child. My parents were extremely shy, very covered up. I don't think I ever saw them naked, Donna Marie says. And yet I'm very comfortable with it now, and so is my family. 866-893-5722. Mayor, in Westchester, what was your experience with nudity in your childhood home?
Hi, you know, my mother seemed to be embarrassed when she would change in front of me. That really bothered me. She was always quick to cover up and things like that. Yeah, that really bothered me growing up. I knew that there was something off about that because I know that it's natural and healthy. And so I'm doing the opposite with my son.
Mayor, I'm sorry, we got such a bad phone connection, but I think you were going to say when you had your son, you wanted to make sure he was comfortable with his body and the bodies are natural, so you're comfortable with nudity in the home the way that your mother wasn't. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Julia in Palm Springs, which has, I know, clothing optional resorts, so wonderful we hear from you, Julia. What was your family experience with it?
Hi, Larry. I come from an Italian-American background, so nudity within the home is not seen as taboo as it as you know it is here in America. So I grew up with it present, and I don't have children as of yet, but I would most definitely raise my children the same way.
All right. And so, and that was with your dad as well as your mom. So there wasn't any cross-gender concerns about nudity, even as you got older?
As I got older, my dad actually wasn't present, so I can't.
Okay. Yeah.
Do both genders, but my mother was very free.
All right, Julie, appreciate it. 866-893-KPCC. AJ in West LA says, I grew up in a Catholic convent where you couldn't even be nude in front of your roommates. One girl would undress, one in the closet, one in the bedroom. It left me terribly ashamed of my body. That's AJ in West Los Angeles. Rob in Glendale. Rob, thanks so much. What was it like when you were a kid?
Thanks, Larry. You know, I like to say that we were naked by necessity. We grew up in a small house outside of Chicago, and we had one bathroom with a shower. So in the morning, all the way through high school, my brother, myself, my dad, and my mom, we'd be hopping in and out of that shower naked as a jailbird in front of each other. One was brushing their teeth. One was going to the bathroom. One was in the shower. So just out of necessity, we were naked pretty much every morning, every school morning. For many years, and I think it just, it was natural, obviously, and it was something that just had to be done because of our living space.
Yeah, it's a practical matter. Rob, I appreciate it. Good to have you with us. Thanks very much. Ashley in Long Beach says, I grew up with sisters and my mother and all of us were really comfortable not having clothes on. My dad made a comment when I was 12 that I should stop being naked in front of him, and it made me really uncomfortable. That's Ashley in Long Beach. Rhonda in Anaheim says, in my Middle Eastern background, there was a lot of shame and guilt in the house. Nudity was not acceptable, and it made such an impact that I changed that with my own child. Bodies are natural, but if you put shame on it, it makes it a shameful thing. And let's talk a final call from Mark in Long Beach. Mark, your experience with nudity in the family household.
Now, we didn't parade around naked, but my mother and father had absolutely no issues with being caught, as you might say, by us being nude. And my mother expressed upon us, because she did not have any daughters, that when she got older, she wanted her sons to be comfortable taking care of her. That included bathing and washing and helping her get to and from the bathroom without having to, any issues behind that. So in that aspect, she made it very comfortable for us to be around her nude, even though all she had was sons.
Mark, and that's such a forward-thinking thing on your mom's part that she would do that. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. That's Mark in Long Beach. Thank you for the terrific calls and comments. I appreciate it very much. So good to have you with us as we talk about your experience with family members being nude in the household growing up or with your family today. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk. Film Week will air tomorrow, Wednesday, so you'll be alerted to the long holidays worth of movies. Film Week tomorrow at 11. Have a great afternoon.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.